Well, I'm going to start with a question. How should we worship God? How should we worship God? And it is important. It is important. I wish I had more time to elaborate on why I think it's important. I will get around to that. When you ask this question, how should we worship God? Well, I think the best place to go or to start is to quote Jesus himself. And the quote that I want to draw out from all the many things that he said and did is that those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. I heard you the first time. Worship God in spirit and in truth. Now, there's a lot of information that's packed into that little short saying. Let's investigate more closely and see what we can dig out of it. Let me set the stage for this comment from Jesus himself. One day, Jesus was traveling through a region. He was traveling from one part of the country to the other, and he had to pass through this area called Samaria. And that region of Samaria is roughly aligned with the region that was once occupied by the 10 northern tribes of Israel after they split away from the rest of Israel. Now, the people who lived in this region of Samaria had what I'll call a curious collection of beliefs and practices that were similar to the Jewish people, or similar to what is found in the Bible, but not the same. Now, while the disciples were off running errands, Jesus sat down to rest at a public well. And he started up a conversation with a Samaritan woman who was there. Their conversation was a little longer than just the brief statement that I quoted, but basically he talked about who he was and what he was all about. He talked about the truth of who he was and what he was there to offer spiritually. However, their conversation touched very briefly on the subject of proper worship. If you read the whole chapter, and I'll let you do that on your own if you want. Don't do it during the sermon. Do it afterwards. But if you read the whole chapter to get the context, then zoom in on these verses. John 4, verse 19 through 24. And the woman's question, let me read it. And the woman asks a question. It's a very important question. John 4, not John 19. John 4, verse 19. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worship on this mountain, which was Mount Gerizim for your interest. Our ancestors worshiped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you don't know. We, the Jews, worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and is now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth. The woman's question in verse 19 begs an answer. Which is the right way? Which way is correct? Who is correct? Which way of worship is correct? And the summation of Jesus' response, which is found in verses 23 through 24, which we read, is basically the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The woman, you know, she thought of the Samaritans as true worshipers of God. I don't think anybody goes through life thinking, well, I'm wrong about everything. No, she looked at the Samaritans as true worshipers of God, but Jesus corrected her, saying, no, your people don't know what they're talking about. In a nutshell, that's what he said. Your people don't know what you're talking about. The truth of salvation and the correct manner of worship, at least up until that point, was with the Jews. That's what he said. So some people take what Jesus said about true worshipers, worshiping in spirit and in truth. Some people take that and they run with that. So they interpret Jesus' comments about worshiping in spirit as meaning after the coming of the sacrificial Lamb of God and the new high priest, all matters of worship become spiritual matters of the heart. Spiritual matters of the heart rather than a matter of obedience and action. But Jesus forecast, he said, there will come a time. So he was talking about something that was not there yet, but it was coming. Jesus forecast actually said, true worshipers will worship, one, in spirit, but two, in truth. So if there's a way to worship that is true, there's a way to worship that is false. Seems logical to me. We're going to talk a little bit about false worship of God. Now, the way that the Samaritan people ended up with their strange mixture of beliefs and practices is actually part of the biblical record. Unlike a lot of the other strange things that people concoct, you know, the first message talked about the Babylonians, there's the Egyptians, there's the Greeks, and the scriptures don't address those, do they? And we don't learn anything about their cultures or their religious beliefs, really. It's not the Bible's purpose. It's not God's purpose. But I put it to you that it's important to note that he did tell us about the origins of the Samaritans and what they believe. So we're going to take a look at that. It's part of the biblical record. God doesn't waste a lot of words exploring false belief, false paths that humans take, but he does make this point about bringing out the belief system of the Samaritans. Very little is said about it, but we get enough. And their worship of God, well, their worship of God had similarities with true worship, but it was also very different. And that's actually a big problem, which I think is why God draws it out in Scripture. God wanted people at that time, and I think now, wanted people to understand. He wanted at that time people who encountered this counterfeit version of worship that the Samaritans had. He wanted them to know what it was about, where it came from, and not to confuse it with the truth. Otherwise, I mean, why is it in the Bible? Why would we have that detail? I put it to you that it's worth our time to consider because God cares about how we worship. It came out in the first message, just kind of drawing attention to the sheer mountain of detail and, you know, number of times it's repeated about the Sabbath day. Well, that's focused on how we worship. If you think about the commandments, the first four commandments, well, actually the second, third, and fourth commandments, really, but you could take all four. They're about true worship. So 40% of the commandments are about worship. How to, not to, etc. And I think it's important. This is a little bit of, you know, I don't know if it's philosophical insight, I don't know. But it's important, I believe, because how you worship shapes how you understand God. It shapes how you understand God. And how you interact with and how you view God affects how you move forward, how you act, how you proceed or don't proceed on the path to eternal sonship in the family of God. It's very, very important, fundamental. Let's take a trip down memory lane and look at some ancient history. Because we have to go way back to find where did this Samaritan thing come from? The story of how the Samaritans came to occupy that territory, which I mentioned, you know, the territory that had formerly been for the northern tribes, begins with the separation of David's kingdom into two kingdoms. It wasn't a happy separation. It was like a, you know, it was like a bad divorce. And that sad tale begins with Solomon. Go to 1 Kings chapter 11. Solomon is a very interesting case study in the Bible. I think it's probably one of those areas that you'll never come to a black and white conclusion on who this guy was and how he ended up. Fascinating and scary sometimes. Let's just read 1 Kings 11 verses 1 through 4 to set it up. King Solomon loved many foreign women. Besides Pharaoh's daughter, there were Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites, and they were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Well, there's a lot in there, of course. I'm not going to try and get into all of it, every little bit about Solomon. But Solomon goes down in history as, I think the first thing people think of is this man of superior wisdom. Right? He got this great wisdom from God. And in some ways, his story shows you that wisdom's not the be-all and end-all, because even with all this fantastic wisdom about, you know, the science of the day and things like that, building, construction, practical matters, physics, etc., he still messed up big time. So it's not about head knowledge. There's more to it than that. Because Solomon also goes down as the man who dabbled in everything. Read the book of Ecclesiastes, and you'll see what I mean. He tried it all, dabbled in everything. And he let himself be enticed away from pure devotion to God, as we just read. Now, let's take down to verse 9, and we will read 9 through 13. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Not many people get that. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet, I will not tear the whole kingdom from you, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Well, covenants have obligations, and they have consequences. It was a covenant. God offered the family of David some pretty awesome stuff, but there were obligations, consequences for failure. God was going to punish Solomon for breaking faith with that covenant by taking away the northern 10 tribes from his kingdom. Now, it mentioned a subordinate. Drop down to verse 26. Here's the guy. Also, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. This is the guy. This is the man. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite. So he was from the north, from Zeredah, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. And here's the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the terraces. It was one of his fantastic building projects. He'd built the terraces, and he'd filled in the gap in the wall in the city of David, his father. And now Jeroboam was a man of standing. And when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force, work gangs. He put him in charge of, it was basically forced labor. And he put Jeroboam in charge of this. The work gangs that were drawn from the tribes of Joseph. We know a lot about Solomon, but among his other, not so great qualities, he was harsh. He was a hard man. Hard man. I mean, you read again Ecclesiastes and all the stuff he did. He needed a lot of money to do that. So there were his heavy taxes. And he needed a lot of people. And he had to force them to do what he wanted. And they didn't like it. People don't like that. The many glorious building projects were built by using force to gather workers from among the other tribes. And that practice caused tension among the people. There's a lot of background politics involved in what we read in the Bible. And, you know, I hope to bring it out sometimes. I know I simplify it a lot, but that's what was going on here. Now, putting Jeroboam in charge of these work gangs that were gathered from the northern tribes, that puts him in an interesting position. It could put him in a position to be hated by all these people, or it could also put him in a position to become the spokesman of his people. He could become their advocate when the time for popular resistance and rebellion came. Kind of a demagogue, basically. Go to verse 29. It says, about that time Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing, and he tore it into 12 pieces. And then he said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen, out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have only one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in obedience to me, nor done what was right in my eyes, nor kept my decrees and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I've made him a ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose, and who obeyed my commands and decrees. I will take the kingdom from his son's hand and give you 10 tribes. And I will give one tribe to his son so that David, my servant, will always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem. God basically has anointed and appointed Jeroboam to become king over the 10 northern tribes. Drop down to verse 37. However, as for you, Jeroboam, I will take you, and you will rule over all your heart desires, and you will be king over Israel. If you do what I command you, and walk in obedience to me, and do what is right in my eyes, by obeying my decrees and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. And I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and will give Israel to you. Wow. It's pretty cool. Let's read the rest of it. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. So Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. I think it's very interesting that God offers Jeroboam the same deal he offered David. The same deal, a covenant of enduring dynastic kingship. And the same conditions apply. You have to stay true to my commands. The overall context there places a lot of emphasis on worship. I'm doing this stuff because of worship practices. You know, he could have called out Solomon on a lot of other stuff, I think. You know, he was harsh. He made the people squeal in pain. God doesn't like stuff like that, but he was very concerned about worship. That's what gets the headlines. So Solomon's still alive. Jeroboam has to flee to Egypt. Get out of there. Well, Solomon dies. Solomon dies, and his son Rehoboam becomes king. What's happening in the background is some form of populist revolt is afoot. People are not happy. They're agitated. Rehoboam goes to the city of Shechem, which is a place that's in the north, part of the northern tribes. And I believe it was probably a historic meeting place of the tribes that goes back to their former association as, you know, more like a federal group of tribes, you know, working together. You can read a little bit about that in Joshua 24. But what's happening here, we're going to read the verses that go along with this. I'm sort of just laying it out for you first. The northern 10 tribes are reasserting their right to approve who's going to be their king. And they bring back Jeroboam to represent their common cause and to ask for concessions from the king. Basically, they're going to say, lighten up. Lighten up on the forced labor. And probably they were going to talk about taxes and stuff like that. Lighten up and we will remain loyal. So let's read that. Verses 1 through 5 of chapter 12. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone there to make him king. And when Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt when he had fled from King Solomon, he returned home from Egypt. So they, that's the northern tribes, sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father put a heavy yoke upon us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. So they were looking for concessions, you know. We'll accept you as our king if you just, you know, give us a break. And Rehoboam answered, okay, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. Let me think about this. So the people left. Rehoboam is thinking about it. So he seeks counsel. He asks his advisors, what should I do? What should I do with these people? And there are older advisors who I take it as they're kind of cynical. And they say, look, just tell the people what they want to hear. And then they will be your servants forever. And you can do whatever you want with them. That's my take on what they say. And the younger man, he says, oh, okay. Well, then he goes and he consults his buddies, probably, you know, guys his own age and so forth. And the younger men say, no, be bold. And that's kind of, you know, young men are like that. Be bold. Take bold action and show these people that you're an even greater guy, man, than your father. Verse 12. 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. And the king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given to him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young man and said, my father made you a yoke that it was heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people. For this turn of events was from the Lord, to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah, the Shilonite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? And what part with Jesse's son? To your tents, Israel. We're going back to northern Israel. We're going back to our homes. We have nothing to do with you anymore. Look after your own house, David. So the Israelites went home. Rehoboam is another case study, although it's much shorter. He's a foolish young man. He's harsh. He's despotic. He's autocratic, you know, my way or the highway, and he's stupid. Sorry. You know, that's my take on him. It's my interpretation, I know. He's dumb. He doesn't know how to play politics. And he attempts to cover this inadequacy, I believe, by a show of bravado. You know, I'm a bigger and better man than Solomon even. All right. The northern 10 tribes decide to go their own way. I'll summarize what happens next. Rehoboam attempts to reassert his rule by sending his officials to gather the forced labor gangs, kind of as if nothing had happened. So, well, we're just going to do business as usual. He sends people up to gather the forced labor crews, and the people of the northern 10 tribes publicly murder the official that he sends, and Rehoboam has to run for his life. Jumps in his chariot and drives away. Rehoboam then gathers a huge army. He's going to force the northerners into submission, but God tells him, stand down. This is of me. This is my doing. Stand down. I don't want you attacking the north. And Rehoboam wisely, I guess he had some sense, wisely obeys and he goes home. And from this point on in history, there are two kingdoms. There are two kingdoms. One composed of the 10 northern tribes, which were called Israel, and a second kingdom composed of Judah in the south. And then Benjamin and Levi chose to throw their lot in with Judah. Levi, because you know they wanted the temple jobs, right? And Benjamin, if you look it on the map, they had few options. They were kind of surrounded. So they went with Judah. I don't know why. I'm assuming certain things, I suppose. So Jeroboam is in this tremendously powerful position. He got the bigger piece of the pie, that's for sure. We're in chapter 12. Go to verse 25. Jeroboam leads Israel into sin, serious sin. We're going to look at the nature of the sin that he led them into. Verse 25 through 33. Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem, so he started building up his defenses in the hill country of Ephraim, and he lived there. And from there he went out and he built Peniel. And Jeroboam thought to himself, now it's getting scary. The kingdom will now likely revert back to the house of David if these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. Ooh. If I let that happen, they will give their allegiance to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And then they'll kill me and return to King Rehoboam. He sought advice, and the king made two golden calves. Two golden calves. And he said to the people, look, people, it's too much to expect you to go all the way to Jerusalem to worship God. I'm making it easy for you. I've made these two golden calves, and you can stay right here and you can worship God. You don't have to go anywhere. And here are your gods, Israel, the gods who brought you out of Egypt. And one he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. Dan is like on the northern border of the northern tribes. It's just as far away as you can get from Jerusalem. Very tactical place to pick. And this thing became a sin. And the people came to worship the one in Bethel and went as far as Dan to worship the other. Jeroboam built shrines on high places, and he appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. And he instituted a festival, the festival. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month. He was basically taking the Feast of Tabernacles and saying, well, we're going to do it at a different time. Okay, a month later. Like the festival that was held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. And this he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he'd made. And at Bethel he also installed priests at the high place he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. And so he instituted the festivals for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. Well, Jeroboam had some very wrong ideas about what worship of God is all about. He, I guess, sees the activities of worship, the actions of worship, the comings, the goings, the doings, as a tool. He sees them as a tool to manipulate the people. That's what he's doing. He sees worship as a way to manipulate people rather than as acts demonstrating obedience and devotion to the living God. Fatal flaw. Fatal flaw. I always like to speculate, what would have happened if he'd done the right thing? If only. There's so many if onlys in history. But he didn't. He was using worship as a tool to manipulate the people. Now, Jeroboam knew. Think about this and ponder on this. I'll bring it up again. Jeroboam knew he could change the way they think by changing the way they worship. He had some brains. I think he was pretty crafty. He knew the ways of the world. He knew he could change the way they thought by changing the way they worship. God, your creator, knows that too. He knows that too. True worship of the living God, according to his commands, leads to understanding God as he really is. And that is why it's such a big deal. Because it changes the way you think about the most important thing you can think about. Just your relationship with God. False worship of God, and for today's purposes, we'll just call that worshiping him in ways that we dictate. False worship of God leads to confusion. It leads to confusion about who and what God is. I could wax on about that for a long time, but I want to just put it out there and let y'all think about it. Who and what he is, all what he is, what he's all about, and how he interacts with us, and how we are to interact with him is shaped by how we worship. Worship of God on the weekly seventh day, the seventh day Sabbath, and I'll put it to you, the seven annual holy days, which are coming up, are essential to our understanding of the living God. And he knows this. God knows this. He knows everything. He knows this. And that is why he cares so much about it. It's a big deal. Let's take a look at a brief look at Jeroboam's innovations, all these creative things that he came up with. One was the two golden calves. So he gave them these golden calves. Here's your God, O Israel. This is the God who brought you out of Egypt. Now, I interpret that not as saying it's a different God, but saying, no, this is the God. And here's how we can visualize him and imagine him. That's how I take it. This is the same sin Israel committed back at the time of the Exodus. Show us the God who brought us out of Egypt. All right. And so, you know, they get all the metal and they, you know, get nuts and bolts and they put something together. Here it is. A very foolish attempt to render an image of God using humanly devised ideas. And in this case, the calf would represent stuff like fertility and strength in the form of a bull, which is, you know, that's how people conceived of God. But it was a dumb animal. False images of God are prohibited because they lead to a false understanding of the living God. Depicting him in ways, any attempt to depict God is less than what he truly is. That's why he doesn't want us to do it. It becomes an object of our own imagination and a thing that we manipulate. We made it. We carry it from place to place. That's not how God wants us to think about him. Another thing that Jeroboam did was he upgraded all the local shrines. So they'd have all these places all over the country to worship. Jeroboam wanted people to imagine that they could worship the living God wherever they wanted, whenever they wanted. I mean, why go all the way to Jerusalem when you can just stay here, worship, and make your sacrificial atonement in a much more convenient way? And those are motivations that still drive people's decisions to our very day. Another thing he did, he liberalized access to the priesthood. Any Tom, Dick, or Harry could become a priest. True worship also involves an acceptance of God's authority. Painful as that is sometimes. God's authority over who provides instruction, who administers the things of God. A priest represents man before God and God before man. A very important role. And under Jeroboam, priests were, if you read closely what's said there, people of dubious character, you know, anybody. They were untrained. They didn't know what they were doing. And the office was actually up for sale to anyone who wanted to pay. You can read that little detail in 2 Chronicles 13, verse 9. You could buy a priesthood. That's false. It's not how it rolls. Another thing Jeroboam did is he changed the religious calendar. He changed the religious calendar. He didn't want the people traveling to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. This is the example that we have here. So he instituted a counterfeit version. And he changed the dates by putting it off a month to the 8th month instead of the 7th. Now, it doesn't say this, but I presume that he did this to the other appointed times as well. Just my assumption. Now, they may have intended all this as a new and a better way to worship God, the true God. But the true living God was not pleased. 1 Kings 13, verse 1 through 6. By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel, came to this fantastic place Jeroboam had built, as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. Well, there's a mistake. The priests are supposed to offer up the offering, not the king. Separation of church and state. By the word of the Lord, he cried out against the altar. Altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah, there's a prophecy there, will be born to the house of David. And on you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who made offerings here. And human bones will be burned on you. The same day the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign that the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart and the ashes on it will be poured out. When King Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar of Bethel, he stretched out his hand from the altar and said, "Seize him! Grab that guy!" Can't have people speaking against the king. But the hand that he stretched out toward the man shriveled up so that he couldn't put it back out. And also the altar was split and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord. Then the king said to the man of God, "Intercede with the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored." So the man of God interceded with the Lord and the king's hand was restored and became as it was before. It's amazing how merciful God can be even when his dander's up. Always willing to, okay, we'll work with you on this. But God is effectively saying through his prophet, deal's off. The covenant that I proposed to you, No. Deal is off. We're not doing that. Now, we don't read about Jeroboam being a liar or a murderer or an adulterer or taking bribes or being corrupt or being harsh or being cruel or unjust. We don't read anything like that about him. Actually, he comes off more as a hero of the people, trying to help them out, you know, unleash them from their heavy burdens, make it easier for them to worship. He's a good guy, right? God's condemnation of Jeroboam came because of matters of worship. Now, he might have had his flaws. I'm sure he did. But God's condemnation of this man comes because of matters of worship. Let's take verse 33 and 34 of the 13th chapter. Even after all this, and there's a bunch of stuff about, you know, we've read through this proclamation in public, his hand withering, et cetera, et cetera. More stuff happens. You can read about it in chapter 13. It says, even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. And this was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to its destruction from the face of the earth. So no repentance. Now, I gave you this handout. And what it does is it shows you each of the subsequent kings of Israel who came to power during the 200 years that pass, actually 205 years that follow after Jeroboam. If you've read through the book of Kings, you probably know that there's a formula in there. You know, well, King so-and-so was this and that, and you know, he was a good king, bad king, and he's noted for this, right? That's kind of the formula. So I've taken that formula for all the kings of Israel, and I've charted it out for you, gave you their name, year of reign, how long they reigned, and then what the final analysis on these guys was. And then I highlighted the common thread, which is he walked in the way, in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. He carried on in this deadly sin, this fatal flaw. He carried it on, this king. And it says it over and over and over and over again. Same phrase, basically. And, you know, if you know your Bible, you know that when something is said over and over and over and over again, that means it's important. That means it's something God wants you to pay attention to and draw it out and say, think about this. Israel's kings all followed the practices of Jeroboam, which led Israel into great sin. Now, they got into all kinds of other trouble afterwards, particularly with Ahab, who he brought Baalism into the country in a big way. And he was especially noted for that, if you take a look at what's the assessment there, and his son. But most of the other kings go down for this fatal flaw, the sins of Jeroboam. They had other moral failings, and you can read about those in the book of Kings, but what God is really concerned about with people, mortal human beings, is how mortal human beings worship. He lets a lot of stuff go by, clearly, but he cares passionately about how people worship. Because how we worship has tremendous impact on how we understand him. And how we understand our relationship to him, going out and coming back. And therefore, our relationship to everything in the universe. So it's fundamental stuff. You build on that basis. I'm not saying it stops there, but it starts there. Now, even if that is directed toward him, and that's why I made that point about the calves, you know, and they changed the feast, but they didn't make the feast to Baal or Chemosh or something like that. It was the Feast of Tabernacles, right? They were doing this stuff. Jeroboam was doing this stuff unto Yahweh, the living God, right? He made the calves, said, this is God. This is how we can visualize God, and this is how we can worship God. But even when directed towards him, false worship practices that we devise to suit ourselves are not good for us. They're not good for the way we think. And God says, don't do it. And like I mentioned earlier, 4 of the 10 commandments. So Israel gets kicked out of the promised land. You know, you go through this list of kings, and the last guy there, Hosea, actually, he's the one, other than the guys who were like only in for 7 days and stuff like that, he's the only one where it doesn't say he followed the sins. It's funny, you know, it's ironic, this guy, last guy, Hosea, last king of Israel, he's noted as, well, he was a bad guy, but he wasn't as bad as all the rest. But it was too late. It was too late. God had already made his decision, and Israel was going to be kicked out of the promised land. Go to 2 Kings. We're going to zoom forward 205 years. Go to 2 Kings chapter 17 and verses 1 through 6. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years, and he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, but not like the kings of Israel who preceded him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he was no longer paying tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Ooh. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him and put him in prison. And the king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, and laid siege to it for 3 years. And in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, the last bastion in Israel, and he deported the Israelites to Assyria. And he settled them in Halah, in Gozan, on the Habor River, and in the towns of the Medes. So the people of the 10 northern tribes were deported. Their land was invaded. They lost. They were deported to far-off lands. And those lands are what's now Syria. Iran. Those are the lands that are now Iran. Okay, basically. And there is no record in the Bible or in history of them ever returning to the section there in Palestine. Modern-day Israel, if you will. There's no record of them ever returning to the promised land. 2 Kings 17, verse 21, when he, that's being God, tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, son of Nebat, their king. And Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following the Lord and caused them to commit a great sin. The Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, as he had warned them through all his servants and prophets. So the people of Israel were taken away from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. So even after, there's a long listing there in chapter 17, if you go through it, there's a long listing there of all the nasty stuff that they got into, all the foreign gods that they got into, all that bad stuff. You know, there's the Chemosh and the child sacrifice and all that horrible stuff. And you can go through that in chapter 17. But even after listing all the grievous idolatry that the people got themselves into, God makes special note of the sins of Jeroboam, whose chief sin was thinking that he could change how we worship God to suit our own needs. Worshiping God, worshiping the true God in false ways. God draws that out among all the other sins, heinous as they are. Verse 24 through 28. The king of Assyria, now something very interesting happens. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cufa, Ava, Hamath, Shevarim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. And they took over Samaria, and they lived in its towns. And when they first lived there, they did not worship the Lord. So he sent lions among them, and they killed some of the people. It was reported to the king of Assyria, "The people you deported and resettled in the towns of Samaria do not know what the God of this country requires. And he has sent lions among them, which are killing them off, because the people do not know what he requires." Then the king of Assyria gave this order: "Have one of the priests you took captive from Samaria go back to live there and teach the people what the God of the land requires." So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord. There's a problem there, isn't there? There's a problem there. So, just to recap, the people that were brought in to occupy the territory came from various regions around the Persian Empire, Babylon mostly, but other places. Those are the people that are the Samaritans. That's the Samaritans' origin. And there's this problem, and the king of Assyria arranges for one of the priests of the deported Israelites to come back to teach this new population how to worship the living God. This strange God of this new land. What does he want? What does he require? But the priests that he sends are false priests. He's sending these priests that were, they bought their office, they were untrained, and they were specifically doing things God had said no. So talk about the blind leading the blind. So this guy comes back and he's going to teach these poor souls how to worship God. And this, my friends, is how the Samaritans ended up with their weird, alternate, counterfeit version of how to worship, which was patterned after the imagination of a man rather than the commands of God. Let's finish this story. 2 Kings 17, verse 29. Nevertheless, okay, so they heard this guy out. Okay, cool, yeah. And they incorporated this stuff, basically. It says, though, nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled, and they set them up in the shrines the people of Samaria had made at the high places. The people of Babylon brought their god. People of this place brought their god. And it goes through this long list of all these different nations, and they brought their gods. And then if you drop down to verse 30 through 34, they mixed this together. They're the strange gods together with the worship of the true God. So they were bringing all this, basically they were bringing folk religion from all the different regions of the area that they came from. Was it something in there I want to draw out? Yeah, verse 32. They worshiped the Lord, but they also appointed all sorts of their own people to officiate for them as priests in the shrines and the high places. They worshiped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they had been brought. So they were mixing it all together. That's verse 32, verse 33. Drop down to verse 40. After a section there that is basically a reiteration of, you know, God's requirements, this is what I require. It says in verse 40, they would not listen. However, they persisted in their former practices. Even while these people were worshiping the Lord, they were serving their idols. And to this day, their children and grandchildren continue to do as their ancestors did. Again, these are the Samaritan people. A crazy patchwork of beliefs and practices cobbled together from all over, mixed together with a somewhat counterfeit version of the worship of the true living God. Now, it's interesting, and I don't know what to say about this. They had some form of worship, and it did stop the lions, I guess. That's a fascinating subject. You can let me know what you think about that. I think it's fascinating. I don't have an answer per se. And this continued right down until the days when Jesus sat down at the well and talked to this Samaritan woman. And you can look, there's other sections where it talks about the Samaritans. It was a mixture of worship of God and magic and stuff like that. Simon the sorcerer was a Samaritan, for example. That's the background. That's all, I mean, you go back to, you know, that verse in John when Jesus said, okay, you Samaritans, you don't know what you're talking about. That's what he was getting at. A lot of background there, I know. And he said to her, no, look, you got to worship God in spirit and in truth. In a nutshell, that's what it is. And we began with this encounter between Jesus and a Samaritan woman sitting in a well. And she was a woman raised in the traditions of her people, which she just assumed were correct. She would have assumed they're right. And she posed that question to Jesus. Okay, whose worship is correct? Who's right? And he said to her, the Jews. That's what he said. The Jews. Which tells us there's a right way versus a wrong way. And we know from the New Covenant that the administration of worship has changed, but all the essential elements are still there. There's still a priest. There's still a sacrifice. There's still a temple. All the elements are there. They are administered differently, and they will be administered differently in the future when Christ returns. There'll be another big change. Jesus went on to talk to her a little bit about the future, what the future held, and he told her about a coming day when true worshipers of God would worship in spirit and in truth. Two things we need together to worship God: spirit and truth. As I mentioned earlier, the popular takeaway from Jesus' words here are worship of God is now a matter of the heart. It's the spirit that counts. And there are lots of people who worship God in spirit. You know them, I know them. We rub shoulders with them all the time. People who worship in spirit, but do they worship in truth? And the popular takeaway is that if our heart is right, God doesn't really care about how we worship, doesn't care about stuff like that. That's details. God cares about the big issues. Is our heart right? God doesn't care about how we worship or when we worship or where. And we're free to concoct all sorts of different ways to exalt him. And he will be pleased with all our creativity, all the creativity that we put into different, new, exciting ways to worship and experience God. As long as our spirits are there and our hearts are lifted up and filled, that's what matters. This is a false interpretation of worship. God wants your spirit and he wants your heart. He does. But he also wants worship that is in truth. Worship in truth. Because false worship, and that false interpretation of worship is very pervasive. False worship teaches us false things about God. And I could wax on for hours about it. For instance, it implies that God is changeable, willy-nilly. Who knows what he's going to come up with next? It implies that he's changed his ways. You know, he no longer even cares about things that he used to be deadly passionate about. Well, he really held their feet to the fire back then, but he doesn't care anymore. It gives you a false, that's just one of many. It gives you a false idea of who and what God is. That's not how God rolls. He doesn't even care about stuff that he once thought were matters of life and death. He really isn't the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And if that's so, who knows what tomorrow brings? That is not something that inspires confidence in me. A changeable God who will change his mind and everything will be completely upside down tomorrow and you have no idea what to expect. That's a false idea of God. Conclusion. A lot of information to wrap this up, but think of Hebrews 4, verse 9. I'm just going to tell you what it says. Hebrews 4, verse 9 tells us there remains, for the people of God, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. It's still there. It's still on the books. You know, you can read, if you're reading in the King James, you'll notice that they leave out the word Sabbath. Why they do that, who can know it? But they leave it out. It's very deceptive. Most modern translations put it back in. But there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And the disciples and the apostles set us an example of holy day observance, which we go through on the holy days quite often. We have these things there. God still cares about how we worship. And true worship teaches us about our Creator and his plan for salvation. We're going to start up with the fall holy days. We're going to get into the important aspects of God's plan of salvation. And these are very important days, and we must take them seriously because God still cares how, when, where, what. He cares about how we worship. God still cares.